episode of the Whiskey and Watches podcast. Our guest is Michael Stockton of Fratello. Michael lives in Frankfurt, Germany, and is our first international guest. Michael tells us how he started writing for Fratello, and we discuss some recent articles and purchases. This episode is a lot of fun. Verwarnung, ich habe viele deutsche Wörter vergessen. Entschuldigung. Guten Tag und willkommen. Auf der 29. Episode des Whisky und Ohren Podcast. Unser Gast ist Michael Stockton von Fratello. Michael wohnt in Frankfurt, Deutschland, und ist unser erstes internationales Gast. Michael sagt, wie beginnt für Fratello schreiben, und wir besprechen neueste Artikel und Einkäufe. Diese Episode ist viel Spaß. Guten Tag und willkommen zu dem Whisky und Ohren Podcast. Heute haben wir einen Gast, Michael Stockton. Wohnt in Frankfurt am Main, Deutschland, und schreibt über die Ohren von Fratello.
Also. Hey guys, thanks for having me. It's Mike Stockton.
It's great for all of the non-German speakers that listen to our podcast, which I think is quite a few of them. That's a Buzz doing a German intro for episode 29, where we are pleased to have Mike Stockton from Fratello Watches joining us. So, Mike, as Buzz said, welcome.
Thank you. And I need to take lessons from you because your German is already better than mine. So thank you.
My old German teacher, Herr Deschner, he would be proud.
Yes, he would be.
Thank you so much for coming on the podcast, Mike.
Thank you for having me. Thank you. It's really an honor to be here. I mentioned kind of before we started recording, I really enjoyed listening to your podcasts up till now, and just a really good, approachable podcast with some great banter. So I'm really happy to be here.
No, we're really excited to have you. I think it's going to be a fun episode. We were talking a little bit before we pressed record. I think we got plenty to talk about. But as we always start with a wrist and a drink check, Mike, you're the guest. What have you got?
Well, so we start with the drink, right? So I've been listening, and I had to come, you know, strong here, and I made a Boulevardier, and
ooh,
yeah, which considering it's like 92 degrees out of here, that's daring. But I mixed it with so I used the Mancino Vermouth, which is out of I think Northern Italy, and I think I shot you guys a note on that. It's really good. I think you can get it in the U.S. And then I used some Campari Cask Tales, which is aged in bourbon barrels. I think they debuted it at Amsterdam Airport a few years back, and they sort of spread it around duty free, I guess. And I just managed to pick up a bottle when we were in Amsterdam. And then I, for the hardcore part, I used Pikesville Rye out of Maryland. So that's a 110 proof. And as the bottle says, aged at least 5 years. And when my buddies from the US, from Detroit, came over last year for Oktoberfest, they were nice enough to bring me this bottle because I said I wanted a good rye. And yeah, it's a good drink. Ah, and I threw in a couple dashes of orange Angostura because I don't have an orange at the house. So
nice.
There we go. And on the wrist, I've got my new for this week. It arrived on Tuesday, the Breitling Super Ocean Heritage 57, which just came out, and I love it. I guess we'll talk about it a little bit, or I can talk about it now, whatever you like.
Go for it. I mean, I've seen this one. You've been posting this one on Instagram quite a bit this week. It looks pretty fantastic, and we've not seen one in the metal yet. So go for it.
Yeah. So this was introduced like several months back, and you guys might know the press release was kind of interesting because they had a black one, a blue one, a two-tone one, and then one with like a rainbow dial that was kind of a experiment that sold out really quickly, actually. And then they followed up with another rainbow one to benefit some COVID related charities. In any case, this watch takes its cue from a diver from, unsurprisingly, 1957. And It's a watch that the original piece, I had the good fortune of seeing Fred Mandelbaum, Watch Fred, who's a pretty well-known mm-hmm. Breitling enthusiast who now is fortunate enough, and we're fortunate enough that he works with the brand to help them design some things. He owns one of those. He owns one of everything. And he brought it one night to dinner and I tried it on and I was just in love with this watch. I mean, it's like this really slim, delicate kind of diver that goes off in a very different direction than something like a Submariner or the Seamaster 300 from that period, and has this really unique inward sloping bezel that my friend Haroon has, I think, nicknamed as a stadium bezel. That's
I like it.
Also seen on the Rado Captain Cook, which mm-hmm. unfortunately, when this came out, everybody's like, it's a Captain Cook ripoff. And actually this predates that if you really go back to the history. And the watch, what I really like about it, and I mean, I've watched your guys' Instagrams, your private ones, and like Buzz, you wear that, that Tudor. What I really liked about this is that the original watch was like 36 and change in diameter. And this one, the underlying case is like 38 millimeters and the bezel is 42 wide and the lug to lug is 46. And that is right up my alley. I put this watch on and it's like putting on a 36 millimeter oyster case watch. You know, it's just something, it's like that pair of jeans or like that pair of tennis shoes you throw on and you're like, So I bought it having never tried it on. I bought it sight unseen and it is fabulous. And the mesh bracelet is ridiculous. It's actually made in Switzerland. It's super thin, but it's, I don't know how to put it. It's kind of silky, you know, it doesn't catch the hair and it's got these links that can be removed that blend really well into the mesh. And it's got kind of a, you guys can see it, our listeners can't, but it's got a, you know, butterfly clasp, two buttons. It's fantastic. I mean, the only two things I think that get some heat are, so it uses the, I believe the ETA 2824. And that's, you know, a demerit for some who want in-house, but they chose it, I think, because had they chosen another three-hander, the Tudor movement they use in the other Super Ocean, the case would have been way too thick. And this thing comes in at like 10 millimeters thick, which is so cool. I mean, you can probably see how thin it is.
Man.
That's beautiful.
It's ridiculous.
That's unbelievable.
It really is. Like, I mean, nobody makes a watch that thin these days, especially with some sort of sporting intent, right?
Breitling doesn't make a watch that thin these days.
No, exactly. You're totally right. And the other thing is that it's got a push-in-pull crown, which, you know, with 100 meters of water resistance, it's fine. I mean, it's consistent with what it was back in the day. And I think had they gone screw down here again, you would have had a larger case because you would have had some more stuff going on in here that they would have had to integrate. And I'm guessing that this movement really goes to the edge of the case here. No date, ceramic bezel. The loom looks like they stuffed somebody from Seiko into the back of a car and made him come work there for a while. It's really good. I can't say enough good about it. If you know me, I'm a bit of a hoarder and I generally buy what I like we all do, but it's been a long time since I've been this excited about a watch that you could wear every day. I really like it. And I think people should try it on. I'm not sure they will. It is a weird watch. I mean, it is an eccentric piece and it is not a no-brainer decision. I mean, I'm blown away that they made this sort of regular production for a period of time, but I'm thrilled with it.
That's awesome. No, it's a pretty cool looking piece and I'm really excited to finally see one when it makes its way down to our buddies downtown here in Cincy that we tend to go and
just go try it on. I would just tell you to do that. I think you'll be really surprised. It's different than anything you've tried. And because the bezel dominates the case, I mean, the lugs like barely poke out, which is historically correct. It is very different than the Ratto. The Ratto is much more like a standard proportion of bezel to lug, still inward sloping. And it's a great watch. I don't want to take anything away from it. I really like that they came back out with that in a lot of different configurations. But this is very different. It is more – the other watch that is very similar to this historically is if you go take a look at the Gruen Ocean Chief, if you go find that. It was, I think, a bigger watch, but also had a very similar kind of bezel that just took over and also inward sloping. So I'm really happy they made this. I really am. This is like a geek's watch, really.
Yeah. And I think they've done a couple of several of their limited editions lately have definitely been for like, but like you said, Watch Fred, Fred Mandelbaum has been helping them a lot. So I know the Navitimer 8 that they did was a faithful re-edition. Those they've done a really good job, you know, kind of appealing to the enthusiast market here lately. So it's pretty cool that they came out with this. It's also fun that you mentioned the Gruen Ocean Chief because of where they were, headquartered for quite some time, right around here in Cincinnati, which is
Okay. Well, I didn't realize they were Cincinnati. Okay. That's cool.
Yes, they were. Yeah. Nice. It's pretty neat. So since Buzzy has a bit of a reveal, I will go next. I am drinking a good breakfast whiskey, given the time change between us and Mike over in Germany, although it's approaching noon. So we're getting close and I'm golfing here after we're done with this. So I'm just getting a head start on getting my golf game a little bit better, but I've got, didn't mix a drink, just got a Woodford Reserve on the rocks. Really enjoy it. Classic, good, easy drinking one. Goes great with a piece of chocolate, especially their double cast or their double oaked one. That one.
Oh, it's so good, isn't it?
It's so good. Yeah. But that's definitely a dessert. That's a dessert whiskey if there ever was one. But yeah, so I've got that. And I still have, I took a week off recording with it because last week was the 1 year anniversary of the Hulk. But I've got the SPB, the 149, the limited edition Seiko that just came out, the less expensive 62 Moss Blue re-edition, which I put it back on the bracelet today. The bracelet's fine. It's actually pretty good for a Seiko bracelet compared to some of the other ones, but I absolutely love this thing. I've been wearing it a ton. It wears so well. I think two episodes ago we were talking about it might actually fit my wrist and be more comfortable than my Submariner, which is...
Oh, wow.
Not something I thought I was going to say, but it looks so good on the wrist. It's just so comfortable. So
I mean, I'm excited you're wearing it because I have like a couple questions. Sure. I have to say like from the response on this watch, I mean, when you think about they did like a 62 Moss modern reinterpretation a few years ago, which I thought was, but this one is smaller. It's interesting that they changed course so quickly on that watch. And, they came out with this, but the reception has been ridiculous. I mean, it's been unbelievable. I don't know anyone who's bought it who hasn't been completely overjoyed with it. And, you know, what I wanted to ask you, because I've not seen it in the metal, I'm going to, sounds bad to say, but I'm going to walk 20 minutes on Monday evening to the Seiko boutique here and go try it on. They're really good guys there. And, I was going to ask you what's the thickness like, and then with the bracelet on, is it kind of like an overly ridiculously heavy watch or
no? It's really not. I mean, the thickness. I don't know if you can kind of see there. I'd say it's probably between 12 and 13. I don't have calipers. It has a very very slight dome on the crystal, which I think is a great touch. It's not like my Tudor Black Bay that has probably 1.5 to 2 millimeter dome. The little profile, I think the thing that they did nicely is the mid case is very slim. So on the wrist, it sits really nicely. It's a dive watch. So it's not as thick as the Tudor that I have. It's probably a little bit thinner than my Seamaster 300M that I've got, the black and white one. I mean, it wears really well. It's not a big, heavy watch. Like my wife thinks it is, but she doesn't wear watches very often, even the ones that I got her. It wears weight wise probably the same as my. I have the Hulk. Probably where it feels similar weight wise on the wrist. It's a Seiko bracelet, so it's a little jangly, but they're always a little jangly. The clasp is definitely a step up from what they used to be.
So like the push in, and then flip lock.
One? Yep, it's the flip lock with a push in, and it's you can tell it's all machined, which is nice. It's not stamped. Yeah. It's got the little diver's extension up here at the front, which I haven't even operated. Yep. Let me see if I can get it to go.
I have to tell you, like on a smooth. on a small wrist like mine, that's the only thing I wish I could take out, because it almost like goes around, yeah. you know, and it doesn't articulate yeah. as a link. I mean, it's nicely done, yeah. but it extends the clasp essentially.
Yep.
But it's cool. And I mean, their silicone bracelet or straps are awesome now. They're really yes, good.
I've been wearing that almost exclusively, and I absolutely love it. And I think just because it's kind of got that vintage, it has the vintage look, although I will say the one that they brought out on essentially a Seiko Tropic strap is like the one for one with the ceramic bezel and the high beat movement. I think that one lists for like 61 or 63 bucks. And I tried it on, and it's a great watch. Don't get me wrong. Like, I tried it on at Richter and Phillips because they had both of them, and I was like, yeah, but this gets me 90% of the way there for the cost. Like, I don't, the blues are different, but they're close. But yeah, no, the silicone that came with this one is great. And I mean, it wears the lug to lug is fantastic. And I have right around a 7-inch wrist, maybe a little bit thinner. Like it perfect. Like it's great.
That's super cool. That's cool.
Yeah. It doesn't feel like a bit, if anything, it almost feels more like a skin diver in that it's kind of got a very narrow profile. The mid case helps it quite a bit, and it sits great on the wrist. It's probably one of the most comfortable watches I own.
Oh, that's great. No, it's cool. Yeah. You like it. I mean, it's good to hear. I mean, they hit it out of the park with these. So
they really, I mean, and it's funny. I think there's three or four of us that have different color variations in our local Red Bar group. Like, I know our buddy Rick from Cincinnati Watch Co's got the brown version. Our buddy Dustin's got the gray version. I've got the blue. Spangler bought the green Willard, which he is in love with. The new smaller Willard re-edition that's green with the khaki green dial. He loves that. So, I mean, everybody's getting new Seikos. Because this color case profile makes a lot of sense. Like, everybody... I feel like everybody wanted them. You see the Seiko, it's like, oh, this looks so cool. Oh, it's 44 millimeters. And I know Seiko does a really good job of, like, they wear well for as big as they are, yep. but they're big, chunky divers. These being 42 and 40, like, they're fantastic.
Yeah. I bought the modern reinterpretation of the 6159, and I got one out of Japan that they made, I don't know, 300 of it. It was called the Ginza edition. So it's like a green dial with a black bezel. And that one wears really well. And I guess size-wise, it would probably also clock in at one of these numbers that, like you say, you kind of have to make an excuse for it and say it wears well. But it actually fits me. Now, I own a green Marine Master 300.
Oh, and, I love that watch.
Nice.
But, I mean, it's like... literally take a building and just stick it on your wrist. I mean, it's unbelievably tall. It really is. You have to admire it because it's made so well and it's such a cool watch. And I kind of wanted to own one, but if I were good at selling, I just don't wear it. You know, it's just too big. And the 6159, kind of like you said, with your discussion, at Richter and Phillips, it gets me 90 something percent of the way there. Yep, versus
it
this.
Does. Yeah. It does.
So now the last guy to go, Buzz, you've got some news.
He's got a new watch edition.
I do. Wow. Just disclaimer. I did not join the Seiko squad like the rest of Red Bar. So everyone can still wait with bated breath, but
it's a matter of time.
Didn't join the Seiko squad. First the drink though. Spence alluded to it is earlier. I was thinking maybe today would be more of a Diet Coke and Watches podcast for me, but I did get a small splash of Paddy Irish whiskey.
Nice.
It is smooth, easy to drink, and very inexpensive. I cannot recommend it enough. I don't have the Buzz's BS score for it yet. I haven't completed my testing, but it's coming soon. It's coming soon. Okay. More importantly, what's on my wrist? Okay. Last episode, I was talking about a Monta SkyQuest that I had my sights on. And today I am wearing my new to me Monta SkyQuest.
Awesome.
It's the black colorway. Bought it in, I would describe it as used like new condition from someone who wound up being a friend of a friend of the show, and we'll probably have him on a future episode. He had both the SkyQuest and the Atlas, and he wore the Atlas a whole bunch more, and the SkyQuest wasn't getting any wrist time, so now it lives in Cincinnati, Ohio with the Buzz.
Lucky man. You.
Yeah.
Wow. Congratulations.
Thank you, sir. Yeah. So it's funny that this whole idea of, you know, the Pareto split, you know, 80% of the watch for 20% of the money, it came up earlier, because I really feel that in a lot of ways that's the role that this watch has. The proportions are excellent. It's nice and thin. It screams modern sport watch with capital M, S, and W. You've got the sapphire crystal, you've got the ceramic bezel, you've got a very trick bracelet. This is the new bracelet with the toolless micro adjust. Just the proportions are excellent. The finishing is dead on. I really enjoy one thing that I didn't pick up on when I was looking at it on the website is how neat the seconds hand is. It looks like a little arrow, complete with the fletchet on the counterbalance part. The hands are finished really beautifully. It's hard to adequately explain that with words. I really like the stepped up GMT hand. That's a cool touch. You don't see that often. And the bezel, the pip lines up dead at 12 o'clock, which is nice. Something that you don't always
see.
Yep.
And
how they Seiko.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Yep.
You said what we were all thinking. Yeah.
Yep. Looking at you, Seiko.
Yeah.
Yeah, they did an excellent job with this watch. They really did. I understand the hype, and I'm really looking forward to when we start doing red bars in person again, because I think that seeing is really believing with stuff like this.
Oh, definitely.
So you know, it's funny. I mean, you guys probably all remember when Monta debuted and they got a pretty healthy dose of criticism. Their watches were a bit more expensive than now. They were using the Eterna movements, right. And, you know, Eterna ran into some trouble. They obviously, you know, they had kind of a retail strategy, and, you know, they dialed back a little bit, but they didn't dial back on the watch quality. And, you know, when Basel was a thing, we would meet them every year, Justin and Michael from the brand, and, you know, super friendly. And that's kind of a funny thing in this game. It doesn't mean at all that you overlook a watch's faults or anything, but when you meet people who are nice to deal with, it does help. I mean, you want to spend time and learn more about the watch and what went into it. And we spent a lot of time with them. And, you know, I came away really impressed with all those things you mentioned, the finishing and everything. And, you know, for me, and here again, Seiko is a good example, and sometimes Omega. But, you know, a brand like Monta, which is obviously a very small one, they somehow, and okay, they've got Everest in their back pocket, obviously. Mm-hmm. So they know how to get a watch to a wrist, but so many brands, I always say, fumble the ball, like on the 5-yard line when it comes to the bracelet, you know, and they did a great job. I think they and Oak and Oscar, crazy enough, like build a bracelet that, seriously, they ought to just sell them to some bigger brands, because somehow they know how to design and some of these bigger brands just don't care. But I think Monta, especially their dial colors and, like you said, how everything lines up and just the finishing on the hands. I mean, I've talked to these guys and I know how much painstaking effort they put into every little thing. And great that you got one, and great that they're getting that kind of positive response from people who buy the watches. So congrats.
Yeah, thank you. Thanks. We had Justin on a previous podcast. He was actually, I think, our first brand to come on.
Yeah, I think he might have been, yeah.
And, yeah, the passion is obvious, and it's so genuine. It was funny. I was going to hold up on buying something new because I know that they're planning to release something. I obviously don't know what they're releasing, but they were talking about release in the fall. And when the opportunity presented itself for this, I just couldn't not go with it. But yeah, the bracelet's really, really good. The articulated links are a subtle touch, but one of the things I really like about this is a lot of dive watch or sports watches have some obvious link back to the Rolex family, right? I mean, the Oyster case is kind of a basis overall of watch design. But sure. when I see this, I see a lot of their own design DNA and, you know, the kind of proto onion crown, the chamfering on the inside of the legs. It just you see enough, and also with the crown guards, you see enough of their own design that is not being done just to be different, but it's done because it's aesthetically pleasing. And yeah, I think that's another benefit to it. Just another.
Yeah, it's good. It's a good point. I mean, obviously with the whole Everest thing, it's very easy to cast them into the whole Rolex, homage pile, but, I'm with you. The more watches they release, I think they've really successfully carved out their own design language. I know that's kind of a trite term, but I think they have. And, you know, whether it's their logo, whether it's the colors they use for their dials or their hands, they who's making the watch, which is a credit to them, because there are a lot of watches from much bigger brands where you can't say that.
So. Agreed.
Yeah, excellent. That's great.
Well, now that we've gotten through the drink check and the wrist check and Buzzy's new reveal, let's get into a little bit more about your background, Mike. So, you know, obviously everybody who knows you, or I'd be shocked that any of our listeners haven't read Fratello or read something that you've written on there. When I first got into the game, it was Hodinkee and Fratello were my two main sources. So I've seen your writing. I've only been in it for about 3 years now. Seen some of the stuff you've been written. It's really cool to actually be talking to you via a video call to do the podcast. It's just a weird thing, but it's a lot of fun. But tell us how you ended up as an American living in Germany writing for a Dutch website.
Yeah, that's great. I mean, and by the way, I was like you. I mean, I Hodinkee and Fratello watches were really two sites that I read all the time. And obviously with Fratello, you know, you could tell it was more of a European website, sometimes the language and things like that. But I liked that it was also passionate. But anyhow, I'm from Florida originally. I lived in several places in the U.S. And then, you know, my last place in the U.S. was in Pennsylvania. And the company I currently work for, I was there, and I was fortunate enough to have someone I worked for who kind of approached me and said, "Hey, would you ever like to work abroad?" And I said, "Yeah, I would." And I was kind of used to working for much, much bigger companies where that was really few and far between. It was also the kind of thing where you guys have probably seen this, where you get approached to do something and then maybe there's a bad quarter and that opportunity just goes away because it's expensive to get sent over as an expat. And, thankfully, like a few weeks after I was approached with that, thinking it would go nowhere, I was told, "Hey, pack your bags whenever you want. You can go to Germany. And
and it was ausgezeichnet.
Yeah. It was like, look at you. Wow. You are really good. Yeah.
Danke.
So, I came over in August of 2011, and I was supposed to be for a couple of years. And funny enough, like 1 week to the day after I got here, I met my now wife, and I met her through, she works in banking, and the company she works for, she was moving from Singapore. She's from Slovakia, actually, but she was the same relocation company as our company did. And we got introduced via that, which is, it was kind of an interesting expat package. But so we met, and a couple years later, we got married, which, you know, it was a pretty easy excuse to extend my stay another year. And then a year after that, we had our daughter, who's now almost six, and that extended it there. And then I guess after about 5 years of being an expat, I decided to go local, which just basically means, you know, you pay taxes over here. And so now I really have no definitive plan on leaving or going anywhere. I mean, I could, but you know, I'm here for all intents and purposes. So I live in Frankfurt, and it's a city that, you know, not unlike Cincinnati or something like that, is probably a place that people are like, okay, but what's really there? And as somebody lives here and somebody lives in Cincinnati, I'm sure you guys could say, well, more than you think, right? And,
exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. And although we don't have Skyline Chili, which pisses me off. So I could really go for some of that. So, or what is it? Montgomery and ribs?
Montgomery and ribs.
Wow. Yeah. So we don't have that. Or Pete Rose or Eric Davis or any of those things, but Frankfurt is a weird place, because it's like the only city in Western Europe that has tons of skyscrapers. And when I say tons, as many as Cincinnati, but that's a lot for Europe.
Yeah.
So that's kind of neat. There's big airport, of course, and you've got a lot of just big banking city. But you know, it's a city that certainly with Brexit and different things, it's grown a lot. And probably like Cincinnati, the neighborhoods are what count. You know, that's where you find your cool spots to go for a bar or a restaurant. And it's no different here. But anyhow, I've always liked watches. Got into them due to my dad. And he's always liked all things mechanical, like always had old cars in the garage and always tooling away on those. And he always liked watches as well. We'd go to like antique shows and stuff down in Fort Lauderdale where I grew up, which by the way, I mean, I can still remember in Fort Lauderdale when I was a kid going and seeing piles of Hoyer Carreras and Rolex Daytonas for $500. And my dad was always looking at like 33mm dress watches, because that was like a big thing back then. And he's like, I don't like those chronographs. They've got too much junk all over there, all over the dial. And, you know, well, we know what's happened. But and by the way, like, here's the other thing that's funny. He grew up in Florida and was dove like everybody did down there, snorkeled and stuff like that. And he had a Submariner, and he stopped wearing it at some point because he was like, it's so big and heavy. Isn't it like weird to think that like a 40mm steel watch or a bracelet, especially like what the Rolex bracelets used to be like,
oh yeah,
be deemed as heavy? I mean, it's probably like weighs half of what your Hulk weighs, right? So,
oh yeah, definitely.
It's really funny. So yeah, anyhow, I always like watches, and my parents got me a really nice watch when I graduated high school. And then when I graduated college, I bought a Rolex Explorer, a 14-270, the 36mm. I moved to, you guys will love this, my first job out of school was in Warren, Ohio.
Yeah.
Okay.
That's close to my hometown. I mean, wow. Closer.
Which is your hometown?
I'm from the very northeast corner of Ohio, right on Lake Erie. So Warren's 45 minutes or so.
So like Oil City or?
No, in Ohio, a small town.
It's Pennsylvania. What's it called?
Conneaut.
Conneaut, okay.
That's the last place on I-90 before you get into PA.
Anyhow, yeah, Warren, Ohio was – No offense. It was just a tough place for somebody coming out of school to live right away. And yeah, the jeweler there, it's crazy to think this now, but the jeweler in Niles, Ohio had two Rolex ADs and they were directly across from each other. One was like a sub brand of JB Robinson, you know, that company, they were like in malls and stuff.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And, they were losing their Rolex line because they had chosen to take on Tag Heuer, and Rolex was like, we don't want that next to, and they had this Explorer that was at that time a really hard watch to find because they were really big in Japan. And, somehow they had it there. And I bought it and I did the thing that was like popular back in the late 90s, which was like you put 20% down and then you do like 0% interest and pay every month. Yeah. And I marched in there every month and gave them like $150. And I was like, boom, I'm going to use that free credit, damn it. And I wore that watch really until I got to Europe. I mean, I picked up a couple of other things along the way, but that was really the mainstay. And when I got to Europe, I was confronted with all of these, you know, you're in this big free trade zone with a lot of countries, a lot of capital cities, a lot of money. And it was just like, wow, you could go on the internet, like Chrono 24 or whatever, and you had all these watches at your disposal. And okay, when you're an expat, I won't lie, life is pretty good. I mean, kind of, I looked at it like I was playing with house money a little bit, you know, and I decided, hey, I'm going to pick up some watches. And I got really into it and I hooked up with some guys who were really, really astute, like Watch Fred and others, and who really kind of taught me a lot. And, you know, I ended up kind of compiling a collection. And then sort of around that, 2012, 13 time, you know, I told my wife, I was like, hey, you know, why not go to Basel? It's 3.5 hours south of here. So we went 1 year, we drove down, stayed a night, and it sucked, by the way, as a public guest. It was horrible. Like it's like literally like, you know, when you're in the mall and you're looking at a showcase through a window, that's what it was like for a public guest. I mean, it's terrible. Like you couldn't see anything. So we went 1 year, and then the next year I had decided to buy a Speedmaster, strangely. Like I not owned one, but I was like, oh, I kind of need one of those in my collection. And I was just going to buy the basic Moonwatch. But around that time, the Tintin had come out, and
ooh, yep.
Yeah. And I'd seen it, and in person, it was so much better looking than those renders on the Omega website, which are just like, and, and so I went to Bucherer over here, which is a big chain, and
mm-hmm.
gave me a good deal, and I bought the watch. And Robert John had kind of said, well, I should go back. Like I had tried to meet him at Basel that year just to like say hello, and knowing what Basel was like, really wasn't surprising that they didn't have time. I mean, it's crazy if you're a journalist there. But anyhow, I bought the watch, and they had done like a little bit of an announcement on it and the whole controversy over the whole Tintin thing. And I said, hey, I said, I bought one of these. I said, you guys do guest articles every so often. I said, I'm happy to write one and send some pictures in. And I did. And then, I don't know, a few months later, I went to Japan and I bought an original Seiko Tuna, and I kind of did the same thing. And then I just sort of started submitting articles, and I kind of walked onto the team. It was like, it was as simple as that. And, you know, we were not paid for anything at that point. It wasn't until the last couple years of ownership with a German publishing company who doesn't own us now. You know, we'd get kind of like a bonus at the end of the year, which I mean, thankful, but it was nothing big. But it was more, it was an amazing experience to join them because kind of going behind the velvet rope, right? You know, meeting with these brands and really seeing things. And of course you're meeting other journalists that you know the names of. And I really enjoyed it. I mean, for me, it was like, it was just a really humbling experience and just super cool as an enthusiast. Also enlightening. I mean, you meet a lot of characters in that industry. People that you really wouldn't want to associate with, but that's like anything. And for me, all along, it's just been about fun. I mean, I don't write TBT too often anymore, but that was the column that I started, which was really on vintage. And I've always said the reason I did it wasn't because I offer any kind of amazing technical information on the movements or anything like that, but it was really just to sort of give impressions about a watch and show it in a lot of different angles, because I found when I was looking at vintage watches especially that, you know, it wasn't like going to buy a new watch where you could go try it on. I mean, oftentimes you just sort of had to like say, wow, that's a cool looking watch, but I'm going to buy it. No idea what it's going to look like on my wrist or anything, or what are the details like? And I used it as I'm thankful that the team there let me use that forum as a way to just sort of catalog, I think, fairly historically important watches and just put some more pictures out there and some words behind it. As I told you guys before we got on, I mean, Fratello is a fantastic group. It's very different than a traditional business. I think everybody's very motivated, but it's a fun team, and you know, we have a really good time. I think every watch site you talk to will tell you, oh, we love watches and everything like that. These folks really bleed watches. It's really cool. And you know, we don't go out of our way to say bad things or anything, but I like to think that compared to some sites, we're pretty honest when we don't like something. On the other hand, yeah. we don't seek out watches we know we're not going to like either. Mm-hmm. I will tell you that. So,
oh yeah, and I mean that makes a ton of sense. I've definitely, in any of the articles that I've read, even on watches that you guys do like, you know, I get you guys tell us what the flaws are in certain things, which is fantastic. And I will just, you know, give you a little plug on that TBT article. I've looked at so many vintage Seikos and other random vintage watches you had on it. Like this, what is it? The Seiko Navigator Timer, the World Timer edition. Like I've looked for that watch so many times. Everyone's like, because I know you featured that one. That watch is such a cool watch.
Yeah. So well, thank you. Yeah. And that's the other thing. I mean, I also think that there's more to life than Rolex. Yeah. And I love Rolex. Don't get me wrong. They make a hell of a watch. They really do. And there's more to life than all the Swiss watches that, you know, go take down big numbers at auctions. And that's why I really like to feature Japanese. I mean, they made such cool stuff, and some people are like, you know, they'll pass it off as like, oh, the styling's derivative. No, it's not. It's not at all. And they were at the forefront of a lot of technology, and, you know, they made some really, really cool looking, or did some really cool complications that were just very, very different. So yeah, really, really. And I like shedding light on them. I do. Some people are like, oh, don't do that because now the price is going to go up or they're going to be hard to find. If it isn't me, it's going to be somebody else, you know?
That's very true.
Yeah. Exactly. That's just the march of time. I mean, I still kick myself when I got into watches the first time that I didn't just shell out the $5,000 at the time to buy a GMT Master II, you know, back when they were still used watches before they became
not vintage. Yeah.
Yeah. It cracks me up that your entry into the Fratello family involved a Speedmaster. Right, the purveyors of Speedy Tuesday.
Yeah,
that was like the gang initiation. Right, you have to buy a Speedy. That's really pretty funny.
I mean, it kind of led me to them, right? So when you buy a Speedmaster, I mean, at least for me, I kind of think of Fratello a bit, right?
So. Oh yeah,
exactly. Oh, yeah.
Well, we were kind of joking. I can't remember whether it was on the podcast or just with a couple of buddies. It was like RJ was the first one to, like, that I've seen documenting on Instagram the new Ed White, the 321 in the stainless steel. And it's like, well, if Omega was going to deliver a Speedmaster to anybody, I would think he would probably be near the top of the list after Speedy 2. Like, he sold so many Speedmasters for them.
Yeah. That,
like, yes, yeah. He can have the first one.
Yeah. I mean,
I don't know. I'm not even saying that that's what happened, but it's like, it seems like that makes sense that he'd be one of the first.
No, I mean, they treat us well, you know, and it's not, and look, I mean, they make watches we don't like, and we're clear when we don't like them. But we're massive Speedmaster fans. We do a column on it every week. sometimes in detail that I even like, wow, we wrote an article about that detail. That's crazy. But, but people love it, and you know, it's what we're known for. So, and honestly, they're a really cool company to work with. Reynold Eschleman as the CEO is such a great guy. I mean, I tell people, and I don't do this, but I could literally, while we're sitting here right now, send him an Instagram, and unless he's on vacation or something, he would probably, I could send him a DM and he would probably respond within 5 minutes. It's crazy.
Wow. That's nuts.
He's really that in touch, which is really nice. It's really nice.
Yeah, definitely.
So,
there's so many other good segments though on Fratello articles. Like, I really like the wrist game or crying shame because it reminds me. So in addition to the content actually being fun, right? I like that. It also reminds me of what I would call the golden era of Jalopnik. They had a segment, Nice Price or Crack Pipe.
Well, they still do. Rob writes it. Rob Emsley, right? And
yeah.
I can cut you off a little bit and tell you that the first ever episode that I wrote for Risk Game, I gave them credit and I said very clearly I modeled this off of that because it's the only column that still today, like I'll sit there and read and my wife is like, what is wrong with you? Because I'm laughing. I mean, he's such a good writer. Oh, I can't come up with these analogies that he comes up with. I don't know how he does it. I don't.
but reading it transports me back to me. Jalopnik was golden like 10 to 15 years ago. And it just reminds me of all the like breakfast scotch jokes and the Nice Price or Crack Pipe. I mean, they were just so irreverent and so much fun that like in addition to you know, these featured watches being fun and some of the banter, you know, gets going in the comments.
I appreciate
that thing. Yeah.
I appreciate that because I think, you know, as a European based site that actually the US is our largest, it's our largest audience, but still, you know, we don't generate the comments that the US sites do. And I think Europeans tend to be a little more reserved on that front, although our new commenting system, I think, makes things a little bit easier. But the humor plays a little bit more to Americans. That's for sure. Like yeah. Robert, RJ will be like, dude, he's like, I had to look that up. And but it's fun. I mean, it's just too easy for me with some of these watches to make references to, you know, bad 80s and 90s culture. And
oh yeah,
but it's fun. I mean, it's cool that we're allowed to have that fun, and you know, we're not just banging out pressers. And you know, it's a cool thing to do. I will tell you, like anything. I mean, when you have a weekly article, it can be a bit of a deadline related slog, but I really start thinking about it as soon as I publish the first one, like what kind of watch do I want to do next week? And then I just go hunting for it. And yeah, I mean, there are some weeks I've got more time to think about it and maybe my creativity shows through, but it's a fun one to write. It's fun. It's fun.
Oh, I bet. The Omega you had this week was pretty stellar. That watch was the bracelet on that thing. What was a
ridiculous
so cool.
watch, right?
Yeah, right.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know what they were doing at Omega headquarters during that design, but like I said, the holiday party during that period must have been fun. I mean, they were doing some cool stuff. But it also, I think, you know, on a tangent, it is weird, like how every watch company always has like some weird watch on offer that's not consistent with the rest of the lineup. Like you look at Tudor with that North flag.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
That's like a total aberration from everything else they do now, right? So everybody's got that. And geez, you go back to the 90s and it's even more prevalent. So,
oh, yeah. There was some really crazy stuff that everybody was doing back then.
Yeah. I mean, and not only with watches.
Accurate.
Maybe that caused those watches.
The certain cars had a mirror on the inside of the glove box. Like, what was
exactly.
that?
Exactly.
Yeah, who's for? Looking up their own note? Like, no, I don't think that's anyway.
Schnee. Yeah.
You've got a couple of other things in, you know, we talked about the Breitling a bit, but you have a Crepas as well that I think we should definitely talk about because it's, we have another buddy here who's a big Ploprof fan. He doesn't have one yet, but he's like, I need one of these badly, but I didn't even know Crepas was going to be doing this. And you've got one in for review. Tell us a little bit about that watch. That one's pretty sweet.
Yeah, I actually bought it. I won't kid you.
Oh, really? Okay.
I thought it was such a compelling thing that I was like, yeah, I'm going to buy it. And I think they're sold out. They only made 500 of them. But this watch basically takes it. So it is an homage watch, which, I mean, I was pretty clear when I posted it. I'm not into homage watches. I really am not. But if it's an homage watch made after something that you weren't able to buy, then I think it's kind of neat. And Omega, I guess, kind of just kept on its process of making like deep water expedition watches. And I think if I read right, it was like around the late 70s or something. They made this watch that was also big and bulbous, like a Ploprof, but a bit more rounded. Mm-hmm. And it had a, you know, left or 9 o'clock crown called the Mega Quartz. They use like the F300 tuning fork movement. Nice. And you can see it in the Omega Museum. And Crepas decided to really basically remake that watch, but with an ETA automatic in it.
Mm-hmm.
And they did a Kickstarter campaign, which I missed out on. And I just shot them an email and I said, hey, do you have any of these left? Cause I said, I'd like to buy one. And she's like, we're kind of sold out, but let me look. And they found one and sent it to me. And it's a cool watch. I mean, it's big, it's really big. But like a Ploprof, it has no lugs whatsoever. So it fits my dinky wrist. But it, when I say big, it like goes out this way, like it goes out laterally, really wide. Yeah. And it comes like, you know, the package, at least on Kickstarter, which is what I got, it comes with a black and a blue dial. It comes with like normal diving hands and these like crazy plongeur hands, which I get French for diver. And it comes with a rubber strap, a mesh bracelet, and then like a linked bracelet that's pretty similar to what, you know, the two options you could get on the Ploprof back in the day as well. Mm-hmm. And I have to say the quality is really, really good. A ceramic bezel. You get a lot for your money, which I mean is typical with a lot of micro brands. They put a lot in there. What I liked about this was just simply that it, you know, they chose to go into like a really odd corner of history and redo mm-hmm. this. And they did it well. You know, I've read various things about Crepas and quality control and different things. I own another one that I have via the Divers Watches Facebook group.
Oh, yeah. And
mm-hmm. nice watch. I never had an issue with it. I don't wear it often. It's a little bit big, but this one, I had no problem in putting my money down and saying I want to order it. And It's cool. I like that there's, you know, the micro brand thing. There are a lot of watches I could take or leave, but this to me is kind of cool. It's creative. So mm-hmm. it's neat stuff.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah. And then, you know, I guess the other big piece of news that came out this week was the Ming Diver.
Yes.
So you guys were talking about that last week when you had Dustin on. And
yes.
Yeah. Have you guys ever held one before?
Nobody in our Red Bar group has one. And I know there are people who are trying to get them, or at least if they have them, they haven't brought them to the meetups that I've been to. So I have not held one yet.
So have you held a Grand Seiko before?
Yes. Oh yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So I would say that the finishing, I mean, it isn't there, right? But it is, it's really, really good. It to me reminds me of like when I bought a Grand Seiko 4 or 5 years ago when they were really making very austere silver dialed watches and that's about it. Basically stuff that doesn't appeal to Americans or the larger American market. You know, and everybody said, yeah, you were getting a watch that basically, you know, was almost at Patek or Vacheron levels for a fraction of the price. Also a fraction of the price because you could get steel. But with Ming, I mean, I went, I had one of their, I think two releases ago, like, you know, the copper dialed model. I had the blue dial that I tested for a while. I was just blown away. I mean, guys, I really was like, for $1,300, it was like, no way, no way. Just the finishing was perfect because I see a lot of big branded watches. I see a lot of micro branded watches, and you probably know, like when you look at the case sides, it's either slab like, or when you get to the edges, it's sort of like a matte finishing that kind of comes into each other. It's just not sharp. It's not, and they tend to be too thick. These watches really feel like something that it really should be in the showcase. You know, when you go to your high end boutique, unfortunately they just don't make that many watches. And they came out with a diver. It was sort of based on the concept they came out with last year where they only made 10 of these things. And like I kind of mentioned before we started recording, I was supposed to have one hands-on for the release, and then and customs got in the way. So it should get here in the next week, but I ordered one. I am really excited about it. I think that they're another example, like, okay, very different than Monta or Oaken Oscar, but they put a lot of thought into every single thing they do. I mean, you guys talked about the podcast where Ming was on, I think with Jack Forster, and you know, I like him when we email him. I mean, his responses are always super thoughtful. He seems like he'd be a tough guy to work for. Like he'd be a tough guy to please, right? I don't think he would. 99.9% wouldn't be good enough for him. I don't know. And therefore, you know, I put my money down buying the product because I think they are so exacting. And I would just tell you, I sure hope, well, the 22nd of August, which by the time I guess this podcast will be out, and hopefully I'll do some hands-on with one, but they're going to release another batch of watches. It's like at 2 a.m. GMT time. So it's actually good for Americans.
Yeah, it'll be the night before.
I would just say, I think it's worth getting, and you never see their watches for sale in the secondhand market. So it tells me that either people are really happy, or if they want to let them go, they're gone immediately. So, yeah. I mean, it's a safe buy, you know, it's a safe buy in that regard at this point.
Oh, for sure. Definitely.
Yeah.
Yeah. I thought that it was pretty impressive how well, once again, going back to design language, like there's something very distinctive about Ming, and I thought it mapped pretty well, far better than I would have thought to a diver.
I agree. You know, the complaint that came out about the concept was sort of the same complaint that came out here on this one, was that the bezel is lacking any kind of grip. And the other concern was that the bracelet, if you choose that, is, you know, doesn't have any wetsuit extension or micro adjust, but it's got a quick release system, so you could throw on the rubber strap or whatever strap you choose. And so I don't know. And then there's no numbers on the bezel, but I think there are plenty of examples of divers without numbers on the bezel that have a different type of scale. So, and let's be honest, I mean, who the hell really dives with these things that much?
Exactly.
It's more of, if I jump in the pool, is it going to be okay? And the answer to that is yes.
And
that's what it's for.
Dive watches are mostly pool and barbecuing watches. I mean, let's be honest.
Or beach. Yeah, exactly.
You're not trusting your life to a dive bezel on most watches.
Yeah. And I think that, you know, when I asked, so it's interesting, like I asked them, I said, okay, so the watch is titanium and the bezel is DLC coated steel. And I said, so why on the concept did you go with ceramic and here you went with steel? And I said, also, you know, you went with titanium for the watch. Why did you go with steel for the bezel? And the response was, you know, we didn't want any kind of insert because we thought, you know, at pressure that could pop off. Yeah. And then they also said that with titanium on the bezel, the ratcheting mechanism underneath would have been steel. So they would have had two pieces basically, which would have been the same issue of something popping out. And then for bare titanium, I asked them about that. Why not that option? And they said they just didn't think the contrast was very good between the loomed scale and bare titanium. So it would look cool, but functionally not as good. And they think that the DLC should wear just as well as a ceramic, which I guess DLC actually is a ceramic coating, right? So we'll see. But I like the fact that they had an answer for everything I asked and they sent it in bullet pointed type response. It was really good. Oh, like awesome. I said, he would be tough to work with, but in a good way. So I'm excited about that. I mean, I think that, it's sometimes like, I mean, you guys know this, you talk watches every week. I mean, sometimes you could get turned off or something, but actually when you really step back and look at the watches on offer today, we're in a pretty good place, right? Sort of like cars. If you were like complaining about, you know, the fact that there aren't like a lot of cars, I mean, come on. Actually, if you look at the cars that are being offered and the horsepower and everything, it's a pretty good time to be a car guy, right?
It definitely is.
I mean, pretty much any kind of product, the choices out there today are awesome. But yeah, I think with watches, boy, all the times I could think 10 years ago of like, oh man, why don't they remake that kind of watch? Well, they've remade it, you know, like most brands have, you know? So,
and you have the internet now in big forms. And if you want the original, you can probably find one in decent shape.
Yeah.
So, which that kind of brings me to, I know we're at the hour mark, so I don't want to take up too much of your time, because it's probably around dinner time for you guys over there in Germany right now. But you wrote an article about vintage collecting, because I know you've got a fair amount of your collection is vintage. And the, was it 5 or 10 mistakes you've made collecting vintage watches? If anybody hasn't read that, go find that article, especially if you're considering. I haven't ever pulled the trigger on a vintage watch yet, and I'm always nervous to. But that article is a fantastic read, and you want to give me as a vintage novice any bit of advice for those of us who are considering our first vintage purchase.
I mean, I think the big takeaway out of that article, and thank you for mentioning it. I mean, it was fun to write. The thing is to do your research. You can't stress that enough. I mean, it is true. The whole, well, it's not even FOMO or whatever this current popular thing to say is. It's just, you know, we're all impulsive. If you're a collector, you know, you do think like, oh, I found something and I'm worried it's not going to be there tomorrow. And especially today, like with watches, like when I started collecting seriously 6, 7, 8 years ago, I often talk about the fact that I could get into a 1 or 2 day back and forth discussion with an eBay seller on a watch. Whereas, you know, 2 years ago, I mean, or a year ago, that watch would have been gone, you know, like somebody would have just bought it. But still, I think that it's better to be sure. And even if you miss out, you know, you'll know the next time. And it's kind of like the second thing. There's always another. There always, always is. Yeah. And okay, it might be more expensive, but it's so much better to be sure, because you know, you buy a vintage watch and it's wrong and you're looking for a part. I mean, parts are just horrible to find, especially cosmetic parts like dials and hands. I mean, it's just so hard to find. And expensive, by the way. I mean, I'll give you an example in a sec. You know, the other thing I didn't mention in there too, and this isn't really something I don't think anyone would do who is a new collector, but it's also really wrong to buy a watch that's incomplete and think you're going to find the parts easily. I mean, mechanical stuff, fine. I mean, you go buy like a common Seiko reference, that's just as easy as buying a cheap donor. But, you know, you go buy that rare dive watch without a bezel and think, oh, I'm going to find that bezel. Good luck. I mean, good luck. Yeah, there's a reason why probably it was for sale, because the guy could never find a bezel. Yeah. You know, it's true. You know, give you a good example of a real big mistake I made, and I've never really written this story, although friends of mine know it, but my dad had a Submariner before he bought his first Submariner. So he bought a 1680, which was the, you know, the date window, the date, you know, he bought it in like the late 70s. I think he told me it was like 650 or 700 bucks, which was not chump change back then, but
right. Yeah.
700 bucks did not grow to the same level as your Hulk, by the way.
It did not. I've done that math. It did not.
Yeah. They took a premium, but, but anyhow, before that, he actually had a, like a 1966 5512, which was, you know, without date, chronometer certified, actually like the watch that Steve McQueen wore. Mm-hmm. And he got it. It's a pretty funny story. Like he's a retired dentist. And back in those days, like in the early 70s, you know, still in America, people pay with a check, right? And the patient came in who was a like a ship captain, basically like charters and stuff like that. And he brought in his girlfriend who needed some dental work. And, here's my dad just out of dental school. And the guy was his patient. And he said, look, he goes, you know, she needs some dental work. And, he goes, but I can't write you a check because my wife handles all the banking at home, you know? and he's like, would you take my Submariner? And my dad's like, okay. You know, he didn't have the money to buy a nice dive watch. He was diving in something that he bought at Sears for 19 bucks, like a few years before. And, so he took this sub and he ended up giving it to me. And I think it was like in, and it was like well-worn, but nice watch, but polished and all that good stuff, but a great watch. And here it stopped running. And I think it was like 2003. I was living in Detroit and I went to a jeweler who was well known for doing a lot of watch service. And I was like, yeah, I said, really like to get this watch fixed. And the guy behind the counter was a bit of a, let's say a Sharpie. Yeah. And he pulls out this service dial to replace my dial. And I'm like, oh yeah. I was like, that looks so much better. And I ended up swapping the dial. I somehow got the hands back. I got a replacement bezel. So I lost that. And yeah, like 10 years later, I had moved to Germany. I started hunting for correct replacements. And let me tell you something. It took 2.5 years to find a dial. And I think I paid 800 bucks to service that watch. And it was a bad service. and so not only was the service bad that I had where I lost all the parts, but I ended up paying like 3 times that amount just to get this dial. And it was an expensive mistake. So anyhow, lessons are, don't ever think that finding a replacement part's going to be easy or cheap. It won't be.
Jeez, yeah. It doesn't even have the salacious history of the original dial, you know.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's a good point. I mean, thankfully though, the outer part you could put into a ultrasonic cleaner because yeah, it lived a life, didn't it? I'm sure. But that also makes watches fun. Those kinds of stories, I think, you know, and. It's like I said in the article, you're going to make a mistake and it's okay. I mean, everybody makes a mistake. And, you know, for me, okay, condition is kind of important, but I actually like a well-worn watch. I like an honest watch. I like a watch that shows that it's been used as long as it's all there and it hasn't been polished to death or whatever. I don't mind if lume is degraded or whatever. So I think it's also about finding what it is you like and not listening to the trends or, you know, going on Instagram and saying, oh, you know, I have to get that because this guy got that. And you know, it's finding what you like. If you like weird watches, like I put on Risk Game last week with weird bracelets, then go for it.
Yeah.
You know, it's okay. If that makes you happy, do it. I mean, I always say, like, it's just cool that we have people so into such an antiquated product in this day and age, right? So any kind of mechanical watch or older watch is a good thing. So,
oh yeah, definitely. Yeah. Well, you know, I think that's a good note to end on. Mike, we really appreciate you coming on. Where can people find you on the socials, the Instagram? Obviously they can find you at www.fratellowatches.com. All your pieces that are out there. Where else can we find you?
So you can find me literally and figuratively at Mike in Frankfurt. That's where I am. So Mike in Frankfurt is my Instagram handle. And yeah, I really appreciate you guys having me on. I mean, A, it's always nice to talk to Americans. I can use all sorts of, you know, obscure cliches and things like that. And it works well. I even mentioned Eric Davis, which was great.
Yep,
I
mean, you did.
He was my favorite baseball player. He really was. I don't think I think like the weird thing about him is I don't think he ever played more than 135 games a season because he was always injured. But
yeah,
man, that guy can play. And yeah, I think he hit a pretty, pretty defining home run in the 1990 World Series. So, but yeah, I really appreciate being on, and I hope to meet you guys in person. I mean, I would love to get over to the US, and clearly if you're ever over here in Frankfurt, always welcome, and take you to a great cocktail bar near here who he's got great whiskey. So
awesome. We didn't even get to talk about whiskey on Amazon, which super jealous, by the way.
yeah, I mean that's true. Like, yeah, we've got next day delivery on alcohol on Amazon over here, and the bourbon selection's getting better and better. It's getting better and better. Yeah, it's crazy, right? So
yeah,
it's so nice.
Yeah, whiskey delivered to your door in Germany. That's fun.
Yeah.
Anyway,
it's dangerous.
I can imagine. Well, no, it was great chatting with you for just over an hour. I'm sure our listeners are going to absolutely love this. And like we said, check out Mike on Fratello. He does their podcast. It's a fun listen as well. I can say I've been listening to that pretty religiously when you guys drop new episodes. So it's great to have you on. And I had a sneaking suspicion, you know, we may be in touch again at some point here. It's been a fun chat. And we always joke that we like to have return guests, and we've actually started to have some. So yeah, at some point, we'll definitely have you back. It's been an absolute blast hanging out with you today.
Yeah, thank you. And I'd love to do it again. It was
awesome.
Truly a lot of fun. So
all right,
thank you.
Thanks, Mike. And have a good one, everyone.
Thank you for listening to another episode of the Whiskey and Watches podcast. If you like what you hear, please take the time to rate and review us wherever you get your podcasts. We are enthusiasts, not experts, so don't at us. But you can find us on Instagram at whiskey.and.watches.podcast. Also, visit our website at zeitzwatches.com. Zeitz is spelled Z-E-I-T-Z.